Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Antifada. We got a strong solo this week, which is to say that Andy will not be appearing due to circumstances. We're going to have some awesome guests, though, one of whom you know and one of whom you're going to be meeting for the first time. But before we go into all that, very important, on Sunday, September 29th, it's coming up, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Chicago Public Library, West Loop Branch in Chicago, Chi-Town, USA, there is going to be the first public meeting of the Independent Labor Club of Chicago. So if you're in that area, or if you're in that region, if you live in Illinois or any of the surrounding areas, go on down to the West Loop Branch Public Library in Chicago, 2 to 4 p.m., Sunday the 29th, and meet some great people, including Jamie Merchant, who's going to be involved. Great get from, you know him from the Brooklyn Rail and his political economy. Now that that's out of the way, I'm happy to announce our two guests today. We have, first off, returning champion, many-time returning champion. I'd say maybe four, five, six times at this point. We have Ross Wolf. Hello.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Really, really good. And we have, for the first time ever, Cosimo Pantaleoni, who is visiting us from the fair country of Italia?
Italy.
Yeah. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. We're going to talk about your work. We're really going to give the floor to you today to discuss your historical writings and analysis. And then later we'll talk some politics too. And then we're going to maybe bounce ideas about like piracy and communism, or like what like a Bordigist piracy would look like. But in the meantime, piracy is the word of the day. Cosimo, you've done a lot of work on this. This is your sort of scholarly interest. Tell us a little bit about what it is you do and what you study.
Yeah, now I've been, I dedicated my last 6 years of, between my master and my PhD, I got interested into studying piracy. I remember that I was a BA student in Paris, France, and at some point I had a professor who told me about a book we should absolutely read. I don't remember the title, but the author was Marcus Rediker.
Aha, shout out to Rediker, man. Yeah.
He's a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. We'll maybe talk about him a bit later, because I met him last year.
Nice.
In the end.
God bless America, huh?
Yeah.
Only in America can you get that experience.
And this was back in 2018, I guess. And since then, I'm an historian myself. I graduated in history and started a PhD. I'm a candidate at the European University Institute in Florence. So I got back to Italy at some point. And I thought that this was, that Rediker's books were really very good, smart interpretation of piracy, which is, it's a phenomenon that everybody knows a bit about because of novels, because of movies. But it's kind of, I don't know how to say, romanticized.
Yes.
It's a subject that is very common in our in contemporary imaginaries about world history. Everyone is fascinated with piracy.
Yeah, Johnny Depp, he's stumbling around, he's giving bon mots, he's got wenches, he's got sea fights and all that. Yeah, we're familiar.
Treasure Island, we all read in school.
Exactly.
Of course, yeah.
And what Rediker was doing, he thought, and that was the big historiographical take for maritime history as a whole, to say that pirates weren't just adventurers in search for adrenaline, we would say today.
Or booty, or wenches, or whatever.
Yeah. His idea is that pirates would be seafarers escaping from the imperial navies, mostly Spanish, French, and British, of course, gathering in these Caribbean islands. Of course, when we talk about Atlantic piracy, most of us think about the Caribbean, because that's where we could find most of the pirates back in the 18th
it's
century.
Where Johnny Depp is from. He is a pirate of the Caribbean, right?
Yeah. And so, and that's, as probably many of you know, this was a period in which global capitalism was at its very beginning, let's say.
We're talking late 16th, 7th, and 17th century?
Yes. More for Atlantic piracy, it's more between the 17th and the 18th.
Okay.
But yeah, I thought that this was a very good idea. It was very fascinating. And so, but as in the Mediterranean, we have some earlier examples of commercial capitalism, as were the Italian communes, Florence, Amalfi, Pisa, Venice. In my case, I'm on the Venetian side. Mm. That's what I study. That's where I go to the archives.
All our Genoese fans, don't flame us for that.
Yeah, I
don't
want to see. Of course.
Yeah, I don't want to see anti-Venetian comments. All right, we had enough of that last episode.
Yeah, exactly. And so yes, my idea was to put Rediker's scheme, let's say, cycle between let's say discipline on board the ships and piracy on the outside. To put it in the Mediterranean, the situation is quite different there. But yeah, so that was the let's say the start of the project, thanks to a professor who was also a comrade, named Alessandro Stella, who used to be teacher in Paris at the School for Advanced Studies in Social Sciences. Which is a very friendly, a very environment. It's really a research school. It's not even a university or a college. It's really a place where the exams are the papers you present. So there's a lot more of interaction between scholars and students.
It's a progressive school.
Exactly. Yeah. It's similar to the New School in New York. I think they were actually born kind of together in the same. I don't know if it's a legend, but still.
It's all that cultural Marxism, Frankfurt School sort of shit. Yeah, exactly. We're familiar with that.
Yeah.
Before we go on, I'd like to simply point out, before you give us the whole spiel on pirates, which we're very interested, you are the ideal guest because, number one, you're in person. Number two, you come bringing experience from the old world, right? Like, we can talk to you about Italy, what's going on over there with the politics, blah, blah, blah. Also, you're a communist intellectual, and academia has not ruined you yet. Like, maybe someday in the next 5-10 years, we would have you back, and you'd be like, hello, I'm Cosimo. Yeah. This is my thesis, and you'd be, like, citing sources or whatever. We're not going in for any of that shit. We're getting you raw and uncut.
Yeah. For now, let's say that I kept resisting to it, but I don't know if I'll carry on with academia in the next few years. I'm finishing my PhD thesis right now, and I feel that I need maybe to switch to something else in my life. I don't know. I'll have to submit it and then think about it.
Oh, maybe the Maloney government is hiring. I don't know.
I hope not.
I hope not.
But yeah, so let's say that I feel research is my life. Any work I'll be doing in the next few years, I'll carry on writing and reading. I did that since I was a kid, so it's okay.
I think we're all alike in that way,
whether
we're actually like in academia or not.
Yeah,
reading, writing, thinking, all that stuff.
Parents are used to say, and my parents, I mean, it was the same for me, that everyone should, I mean, that the kids should find a job that they like.
Mm-hmm.
And which is good. I mean, of course, we have to tolerate what we do. But if our work fully corresponds to our life, it starts becoming a whole mess.
I think that's right. I mean, I do some of my best thinking about capitalism and communism with a hammer in my hand. And I'm not even being ironic right now. Like, when I'm on the job, it's like really, really good to not have to, like, I don't know, be thinking about anything besides what I want to think about, because I'm just mindlessly doing stuff. So a good combination is good. But we're not here to talk about wage labor, mine, yours, or anybody's. We're here to talk about the 16th and 17th century. We're here to talk about your work. How you got us to the point where you discover Rediker, The thesis about early modern capitalism in the transatlantic world. And of course, with Linebau too, this sort of republicanism thread that runs through all of that in and out of the pirate experience. So tell us what where you go from there. You apply these same sort of theories to the Mediterranean. Is that right?
Yeah. So I got in touch with Alessandro Stella, the professor I told you about. And he said, okay, you want to study pirates? That's a good, it's a good topic. Why don't you study the Uskoks, who were a community of pirates gathering in northern Croatia, what would be Croatia today, so on the Adriatic Sea.
How do you spell that?
The Uskoks.
Uskoks, okay.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I know this for the future.
Double K, yeah.
Okay, Uskoks, gotcha.
I mean, not double K, but there are two Ks in the world.
Okay.
So
I'm not going to make the very easy joke about using cocks right now. Yeah. I'm just not going to do
it. Yeah, 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 no. So these Uskoks, actually, it's a word that comes from southern Slavic languages. So what would be Croatian Serb today? And it means refugees. Mm. These were Christian refugees from inner Balkan provinces.
Oh, that's our third guest. That is Shug. If you hear any barking, it's because, I don't know, she's on patrol right now.
Yeah.
She's going to sniff Ross's foot and see if he checks out or not. You might hear more barking, but I'm sorry. Go on.
No, so these Christian refugees were gathering on the Adriatic coasts because, I mean, there was a sort of perpetual warfare, state of warfare since the Ottoman invasions of the Balkans. So since the end of the 15th century, actually. So it's really a long run history. They were gathering in southern Croatia at the beginning, in Klis. Then they were chased by the Ottomans and went to the north, up to Senja, which is a place close to the city of Rijeka.
Mm-hmm.
What would be to nowadays Rijeka, that was called Fiume by mm-hmm. the Italians. And so these pirates, let's say that they were my only objective at the beginning of my research. When I first went to the state archives in Venice, which are in a beautiful former monastery cool. in front of the Frari Church.
Cool.
It's a beautiful place to visit, as the city as a whole, of course. So I went there and I started looking for judgments, for trials, for mm. judiciary records. And I actually found them. And so I said, yes, I'm going to write my master thesis and eventually a PhD project about it. But then at some point, I mean, this was already enough for me at the beginning because mm. I had found my pirates to study. I could study their origins and prove that, I don't know, that was the hypothesis at the beginning, Rediker's one, that these people were just poor people in search of fortune that would attack the ships in the Adriatic just to live a better life, mm. like the Caribbean pirates. That was the biggest take.
They were adventurers, basically.
Yeah, exactly, right. At the beginning. Then, through the judiciary records, I found out, I actually realized that these that there were courts aboard the Venetian galleys.
Mm.
So the galleys were ships, or ships, actually sail ships too, but sails were less frequently used than the oars, because in the Mediterranean, as you know, it's not so windy all the time. Mm. It's different from the ocean. Climate is different. So these military or ships named galleys were used to chase pirates
mm.
By the Venetians. As you know, the Venetians were a commercial power in the Mediterranean. So the first objective of the fleet, of the military fleet, was to chase pirates, like the Uskoks. At some point, I realized that some of the Uskoks were actually were sentenced to the oar on board the galleys.
Oh, to be on the galley. There she goes again, Shug. I'm going to have to lock you out. Keep going while I get this mad dog out of here. Please continue.
Yeah. So on board this guy, let's say that these galley ships worked as mobile prisons. These were moving jails, and people would be condemned by, I mean, judges to row the oars of these ships.
Which was because there was a lot of naval warfare at the time, could be a death sentence, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the fleets were in great need of rowers. You could find up to 150 to 100 per ship. Mm-hmm. It was really packed on board. So, yes, I realized that USCOC men that were sentenced to the oar were actually rowing alongside other sorts of criminals that were condemned for thievery, for contraband, for many sorts of crimes.
So there, this was not in this period, what, the 15th and 16th century? This is not wage labor to be working on the oars.
No, I mean, there were some wage workers, but that's the interesting point about it. The galley works both as a jail and as a court together. So captains of the galleys could send waged rowers. Some of them were actually waged, because at some point, mid-16th century, there was a reform. You have sentenced people, you have convicts. You start having convicts on board these ships. At some point, the Venetian Senate realized at the end of the 16th century that this was too much at some point, that there were a lot of tensions on board. So they start putting some waged workers again. But the captains had a judiciary mandate to condemn the waged rowers and make money out of it, because they didn't have to pay them.
Oh, I see. If they brought them up on a crime, they wouldn't have to pay their wages.
So even if probably the Venetian Senate was willing to let's say, to reintroduce some, let's say, people that weren't convicts, as part of a sort of humanitarian reform, it was interpreted like this by other scholars. I actually found out through these records that captains were carrying on condemning people to the oar directly on board. Wow. the galley. That's the point. That's the main point. And through the records, I also realized that some of the galley men, both waged and convicts, were actually behaving in the same way as the pirates would do outside. Hmm. They would traffic objects that they took from the navy all the time when they happened to stop in a harbor. They actually robbed a lot around, and most of the time they say it's for survival. Mm-hmm. The records, I mean, they prove that these people actually needed to rob all the time. We know that crime has a lot. I mean, even today, I believe it's more or less the same. Crime has a lot to do with class.
Yes,
let's say. And that was my biggest stake from Rediker's work, as I was saying. So at some point, I realized that there was a sort of micro piracy on board the ship. Mm. And that's the most interesting point. You have USCOC who are condemned to the galleys. You have galley men that have nothing to do with pirates, that rob, that have all these
remove contraband and do exactly. Black market. Yeah,
that behave as sort of micro pirates. And there's a part. Actually, people could get in touch with actual USCOC pirates or other sorts of bandits and pirates. And so some of them escaped to join the pirates.
Wow, okay.
So there's a whole world made of pirates.
Yeah, and it seems to me that there's like a continuum of pirates, right? There are, if you're quote-unquote legally an oarman on a galley, you're doing micro-piracy. If you escape and you end up on a pirate ship, then you're doing macro-piracy. But this
idea. That's the idea.
Yeah, because the sea is, despite the galleys, as you say, being like mobile court, like a mobile court system with its own rules and whatever laws and enforcement, the sea is still pretty lawless, right? Like the border between a galley and a privateer is a little thin at this point, because I assume Venetian galleys could raid, say, Ottoman ships if they ran into them.
No, actually, that's a particular case within Christian powers, and it's part of the Jus Cox history, but let's say the Ottomans were actually allied with the Venetians.
Ah.
Despite Lepanto, the famous battle, 1571, there was this enormous battle in which all the Christian powers, they were fighting together against the Ottomans, but... right afterwards, Venice signed a separate treaty, peace treaty with the Sultan Selim II, I guess.
All those trad like neo crusaders online are going to be pissed when they find out the Venetians
exactly,
were traitors.
Exactly, exactly.
That
that's
actually
the point.
The money and the power was more mm-hmm. important than Western civilization.
Exactly. Actually, Venetians they wanted to keep a commercial. Thing, let's say they wanted to keep trade with the Levant, and they needed a compromise with Ottomans. So they asked for Christian support once the Ottomans invaded Cyprus. But then, in the end, after Lepanto, they kind of gave up in spite of the victory of the battle. And in the end, they stayed. I mean, for most of the 17th century, the Ottomans and the Venetians are really. Not allied, but let's say they are partners. They are commercial partners.
They had a modus operandi, and they would agree not to raid each other's ships.
Exactly. Gotcha. Exactly. And it was the Venetians' responsibility not to allow Jus Cox to attack Ottoman merchants within the Adriatic Sea, because that sea, what it was, the Venetians like to call it the Gulf of Venice.
Oh, they would.
And you
like
see,
to
the Adriatic has this sort of tunnel shape. And it was considered a monopoly area of Venice. That's the point. But yeah, let's say that the Venetians in general were in charge of the repression of contraband, of piracy in the whole Adriatic on behalf of other commercial powers too.
Gotcha.
That's the point.
Yeah.
What did I say?
Where were we? Okay, so you're developing your thesis, and you understand the Jus Cox, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, to have been a displaced people, an exile people, a refugee population, and they are pressed into working on these galley ships. Some of them stayed, presumably many of them died. They were engaged in micro piracy, and then if they had a chance to escape, they would become Adriatic pirates, pirates of the Mediterranean. Is that?
Yeah, that's the idea.
It? Okay.
And yes, you were asking me about frontier, let's say. So galleys were mobile courts, mobile jails, but also mobile frontiers somehow. Because, I mean, this whole study of galley ships... allowed me to conceive that if banditry and piracy, as you say, because of the lawlessness of the sea, of the mountains too, I mean, we could say that there are many frontier areas in the Mediterranean at that time, like in the Caribbean. It's the reason why you have pirates in the Caribbean, but you also have maroon
communities
in the jungle alongside.
Communities of escaped slaves, escaped white indentured servants, native peoples having sort of communal existence outside the bounds and the frontiers.
We are all very much fascinated with the sea, but we should keep in mind that these kind of phenomenons are kind of amphibious.
Amphibious, yeah. Right. So there'd
so
be a
piracy and banditry always merge together, and these were mobile frontiers, because if let's say banditry, we can conceive it as the limit, the border, so the frontier of state law somehow. And it really, I mean, the diffusion of the spread of banditry and of piracy, they really depend on how much the state is capable of monitoring a territory.
And there's state capacity in the Mediterranean is very very much in flux.
Yeah. And so as galleys are, I mean, they are military galleys. They are used as a tool of repression, of banditry, of piracy. We can conceive a sort of micro frontier aboard these galleys. It's sort of it's a microcosm of thievery. Let's say always between discipline and galleyman's agency on a daily basis, which lets us. Yes, it. I think it's a. I mean, it's a, it, it's a bit philosophical, but. It's one of my conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting too. I mean, when you discuss banditry, because what always comes to mind for me is the very famous book by Eric Hobsbawm. I believe it's his first book, Primitive Rebels, where he's talking about the origins of the Sicilian Mafia as kind of just you know, on this frontier and of, you know, law and what that expressed in that moment. Actually, more broadly, you know, it was really interesting, you know, when we were discussing this, when you were telling me about your research, Cosmo, what you felt like, you know, this process told us about the transition out of feudalism, especially in the origins of many of these sort of anonymous oarsmen who were convicts, and, you know, just how they arrived and how they were actually rowing on these galleys in chains. And just the various crimes that they were committed of, and how that was tied to the process of enclosures, and just the just sort of bare survival, you know, thievery. You know, they were convicted of stealing a chicken or whatnot, and ended up rowing on this galley in the Mediterranean. And then also you mentioned, and I don't think you've gone into it here, but I'd love to hear you elaborate on it more. The sort of the all the debts that they would incur because they, you know, in addition, because conceivably they could, you know, serve their time, you know, work off their debt, at least in concept. But as they were eating and having to clothe themselves on these galleys, they were incurring more and more debts, and it became this sort of inescapable cycle.
Like debt peonage, yeah.
Yeah, that's the very economic, let's say, core of my work. Actually, everyone had debts on board galleys, both waged workers and convicts, because I mean the actual value of a ship when it these were military ships, so they were I mean the state was built, the Venetian state was making them and then. Giving them to captains, and where when new captains were appointed, you had transfers of ships, and the actual name of the galley could change on depending on who was the new captain, and the value of the ship, which corresponded to what the second captain had to give to the first one, was given by the sum of all the debts of the workers on board.
Okay.
So that was, there are chains, as you said, Ross, and there are invisible chains. Debts are the invisible chains on board. And, I mean, this is a big contemporary issue, too. We could speculate about it for a while. I say speculate, like, for that. Yeah.
That's what we're here for, is to speculate. <Yeah. laughs> We do some of our best work speculating.
So, yes, there were... Sometimes in these judiciary records, I found proofs of these debts because when there are many many cases of escapes on board, some of these escapers would eventually join pirates. As I said, when they did that, when they deserted, escaped from the galley, the judge, or actually the writer, I don't know how to say the
scribe,
yeah, the scribe had to copy the debts data from the ship's book, let's say, that was present every fleet around the world to keep record of the debts that corresponded to what was needed for clothes and food, let's say. So even if you were a convict, you had to pay of your survival yourself, and that's the reason why they actually rob, they traffic.
Right.
It's a very economic reason why.
Right.
So yes, you have this data copied from the galley's book, let's say record, and we only have a couple of them. Most of them were destroyed or burnt. So thanks to the judiciary records, we have a chance to look at the Galleyman's debts too, because they were copied as, this represented the actual loss in human capital. If, as I said, the value of the ship corresponded to the sum of the debts of all the galley workers, if any of them happened to escape, it was an actual loss. So most of the trials I looked at are about escapers that didn't make it in the end.
Okay.
If there's a trial, of course, it's because they were caught back.
Yeah.
But I believe that many of them actually managed to escape and eventually join a crew of pirates.
Either go into the mountains or join a pirate crew. Right?
Exactly. We are talking about Dalmatia. It's really, that's why I was saying it's very amphibious, because it's really a frontier where you have the mountains just in front of the sea,
right,
with many islands, and it's a very rocky for those who had who were lucky enough to get to Croatia,
and also
for vacation,
and also a place where it's not that easy to grow food, right? So you already have a bit of a hard scrabble existence, a kind of frontier existence up on the mountains. I want to continue Ross's question about the transition of modes of production, and I'm not just name-dropping books here, but I am going to mention a couple books I think that are relevant. The first one being, I believe it's Redeker, or it might be Linebow, The London Hanged?
Linebow.
Yeah, he goes through all of the records.
It's
the
his PhD dissertation, actually.
I managed to pick that one up at one point. And it's about enclosure, and it's about proletarianization, and it's about the criminalization of, like, former life ways, former ways of surviving, in a period where, not so rapidly, but certainly very abrasively, society is moving towards not just a different mode of production, but a different legal system, and obviously a different moral system, which is the creation of classical political economy. The other book I would mention, too, is The Slave Ship is that Redeker?
Yeah,
and The Slave Ship, the thesis is that the slave ship produces something, and it produces slaves. It's like it's like a mobile industrial process which strips the West African of identity, of community, of their grounding in space and time, and transforms them in this process of violence and degradation, if they survive this, into a human commodity, which is to say, the slave itself. So those are both interesting, and I'd be interested to hear how this connects with that, because you're talking about this moment of transition. You're talking about the birth, either the Renaissance or later on the Enlightenment, the birth of what we would understand as the modern world, but through that, a violent process, a criminalizing process, an enslaving process that, you know, typifies really how violent and aggressive this transition was. Are similar things happening in the Mediterranean at this time? Because I know that some of the earliest, like, industrial production techniques, I think it was the 15th century, was in the Venetian Armada, right? You had almost like an assembly line production of galleys.
Yeah, definitely.
And wage labor. And
if any of those who listen happen to visit Venice during the Venetian Biennale, which is a very famous exhibit, every 2 years, in Venice, it's actually taking place inside the Venetian arsenal. That was where the galleys were actually produced.
Right.
And it's considered one of the first examples of modern industry in the Western world. So that's definitely correct. Then let me take a step back to the historiography, to Leidenbow and Hobsbawm.
Yeah,
and Redeker. So, of course, Linebow and Redeker, they actually wrote a book together at some point.
The Many-Headed Hydra. Exactly. Yeah.
Because both of them were relying on Hobsbawm's thesis to study the sea. Let's say that, that's Redeker's part, and the London Hanged by Linebo. And Linebo was kind of doing really a parallel work to Redeker's, because he was studying the same kind of connection between crime and, let's say, subsistence practices among the proletarians in an urban context. Mm. At more or less at the same in the same period. It's always the 18th century. Of course, that's the actual century, I mean, in which the British power is at its peak worldwide. It's the actual birth of capitalism. But as I was saying at the beginning, we have some earlier forms of capitalism. Even if we cannot really say that in the Mediterranean we have a working class of seafarers, but there were definitely people that were poorer and that were exploited in a moment in which there's a huge transition between the feudal aristocracy and a more commercial, let's say, bourgeois ruling class. Mm-hmm. That was typically the case of Venice, which was ruled by, it was a sort of, it was considered a republic, but it's not a republic in our sense. It was an oligarchy.
Oligarchic
republic, let's say. And these, so ruled by patricians, who were monopolizing all the state charges. And these people were massively implicated in trade with the Levant. So we have one of the first examples of capitalist accumulation through trade. Then the interesting fact here is that even if we don't have an actual industry, like at the end of the 18th century, much more in the 19th, of course, as everyone knows, here the first industrial complex, I said it was the arsenal in Venice, was the production of circulation somehow.
Production of circulation. Yeah. Right.
And that was the case since the Middle Ages, since the 12th century, I guess, when the Venetian trade with the Levant started really being a thing.
So almost around like building the presupposition of transatlantic capital, but before even the Columbian moment, right?
Yeah, let's say that. Yeah, as we know, the colonization of America was a huge experiment somehow from a European world which was already transitioning from feudalism to some pieces of capitalist economy that were spreading around, especially on the seaside.
Mm-hmm.
Because of connections, because trade allows you to accumulate capital. That's a bit different with the land, with agriculture. We know let's say, of course, the industrialization allowed the countryside to become capitalist too. But it's another history.
Yeah.
So now I think that there's really thanks to Linebo and Redeker, we can really bridge the gap between early modern piracy. Actually, we know that there are some modern pirates too, but it's not most of what we would call piracy today would take place on the web.
Yeah.
would take place because of gangsters in the streets, this kind of stuff.
Right.
So thanks to these two scholars, we can actually bridge the gap between early modern capitalism taking place in this, let's say, in this maritime context with metropolis, with urban capitalism, and eventually even with the third industrial revolution, the one we're experiencing right now. So with the web, with the cyber piracy. Because if we think about the concept of frontier, again, if we take that, today, the whole planet, more or less, has been subsumed by capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
There are some places in which it's a bit more difficult, but let's say that lawlessness is not, let's say, you were mentioning it before. It's the seas became much more, how do you say, patrolled. There are sea conventions on how to manage maritime spaces. But the new frontier, what's the new frontier today? If we think about it, it's actually the web.
Mm.
It's not, let's say that technology allowed to create a sort of new space that doesn't exist and exists and fully exists at the same time. And that's the actual frontier. Mm. We could think about, some people speculate about space pirates, about that's another frontier we could think about. The space, the exploration.
If Musk gets his way, we could all go to Mars with him and then pirate his ass. That'd be pretty cool.
And the mid, let's say, the element in the middle between the sea and the web would be the metropolis. Let's say the wild expansion of these huge cities with the Industrial Revolution, actually. It happened a bit earlier too, but let's say the Industrial Revolution was really the period in which, the first one of course, in which the metropolis started growing insanely. And in the last few days I got very interested in the history of immigration in New York. Mm. And I was reading a book called 5 Points about the oh, yeah. notorious neighborhood in downtown New York.
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah,
that was. I mean, it's maybe it's. I mean, if we take piracy as something strictly maritime, it's not the right word to use, but we can say that it used to be a pirate neighborhood.
Sure. Yeah.
Because
certainly it was a frontier.
It was a frontier. Motley crews were there, as the ones described by Rediker and by myself eventually. Because we know that all these immigrants contributed to the first example of American melting pot.
Yeah, it was a frontier of culture. It was also, you know, it was a frontier because it had its own adventurers, which were like the bourgeois and petty bourgeois bohemians who would enter into these frontiers and like engage in this the culture and the life ways of this motley crew, maybe buy some opium from them. But like the bohemian sense of the ghetto or the 5 points as like a frontier, I think is kind of still with us.
And let me say one last thing about it. Actually, if we think in the long run, the very connection between maritime commercial capitalism in the early modern period and nowadays, third industrial revolution, the web, and what we said about cyber piracy. The infrastructure of internet was actually a development of the metropolis, of urban capitalism that had to, I mean, you at some point you had to connect dots around the planet. And we did that at the beginning, we did that with ships. And then at some point, we started doing that with optic fiber cables in the ocean.
And it's a much more continuous flow, right? Yeah. It's like a real-time continuous flow of that. Fascinating stuff. You had one more thing, and then
I had actually, there's a quotation by Marx. I think it's in the Grundrisse. He says that... we know that capitalism accelerates things all the time. He says that technology allows to reduce the space, let's say.
Annihilate the planet space is through time.
Yeah, it's the annihilation of space by time. Yeah.
Exactly. By the accumulation of time, which is work time. Mm-hmm. It's time that has been spent working by the proletarians.
Dead labor.
By the working dead labor, exactly. That the planet became smaller, and piracy is the dark side of this long run history somehow. Mm-hmm. That's why I was saying that the 5 points could be called a pirate neighborhood. It's for that. It's the dark side of the moon.
The dark side of the moon, which is where Elon Musk is going to go, and we're going to pirate his ass. Here's a question for you, and it's a more of a political question, because as I understand it, and I did write a paper about this back in the day, if the imperial state, whether it's Castile, whether it's France, whether it's Great Britain especially, is centralized and authoritarian and aristocratic, certainly in the Caribbean, pirate ships tend to be run completely the opposite, actually, right? They are decentralized, obviously. They're floating around the seas, not representing a state power. They're also roughly democratic, like small d democratic. And there are these conceptions of liberty that arise out of this pirating experience, which are consonant with a sort of transatlantic 17th, 18th century republicanism, right? Which is obviously seen in the English Civil War. And then later on, of course, in the American Revolution and the French Revolution. But Rediker and Linebaugh kind of tie this pirate experience, this pirate history, to the larger like political expressions of republican democracy in the early modern period as arising out of capitalist social relations.
Yeah. Actually, the idea is that Motley Crue's daily survival practices, piracy, maroon communities, all contributed to what we call the cycle of Atlantic revolutions.
Okay. Yeah.
The American Revolution, Haiti, and the French one. These are the three main ones. And I think that actually I tried to put the same kind of logic in the Mediterranean, but it's on this very political issue, the situation is very different. So Linebaugh and Rediker were studying an environment in which was already very modern in that sense. There's a chronological, let's say, closeness between pirates and maroons, and let's say the 18th century as a whole, and the revolutions, and the political revolutions, and as the ones I mentioned, and the more economic ones, the industrial revolution. My problem was that I was studying people that weren't politically conscious of what they were doing.
Yeah.
So
it would be anachronistic, right, to put this in the Mediterranean.
Yes, I guess that there were still other sorts of politics. People would probably express them in more religious terms,
right?
Which was the case even for the 18th century, yeah, let's say, mm-hmm. yeah, or even for today, we could say. For it depends, of course. But yes, it was very different. So I think that Linebaugh and Rediker gave a major contribution to historiography, to our understanding of class struggles, of course. But my conclusions are a bit different too. Mm-hmm. It's not much the fact of having a sort of underlying ideology to your robbing practice that would eventually coincide. There would be maybe a sort of, yes, of correspondence with the republicanism, with these more ideological, let's say, movements. But at the same time, I think that most of these rebellions are kind of unconscious, let's say. And it really, I think, we can make a lot of of questions out of it. I mean, people don't react because it's because they actually feel the injustice on their skin, but it doesn't mean that they have a whole conception of the world around them. It's kind of different. Like people were gathering and doing that they were pirates because they needed to be pirates. That's my point.
Yeah, I think,
and that's the difference with Rediker, because he thinks, I think he does. I don't know. We'll maybe invite him here one day.
I'd love
let's
to,
see.
Sure.
But yeah, I do think that his idea is that piracy is a very political thing, and that was actually the case with Caribbean pirates he studied. But my micro pirates are more people that have nothing to lose, and they just do that to extort part of the surplus value they contributed to without enjoying
it. And it says something about the society and the world at this very particular juncture. I think there's, and maybe we'll kind of wind out the main episode here. I think maybe what I take from your history and from Redeker and Linebaugh, like the broader historiography of piracy, is not like that the pirates were like all Jean-Jacques Rousseau's, you know, like sailing around, talking advanced.
That's a caricature, yeah.
Yeah, but I use it as a caricature to point out, I think, like what might be more interesting about it, which is that it's like the very real like antagonisms, the violent antagonisms between the imperial state and commercial capital on the one hand, and the proletarianizing sailor or the press gang sailor on the other hand, that when freedom is possible for short stretches of time, because most Caribbean pirates live like 2 or 3 years before they're captured and hang or they're sunk to the bottom of the sea, for this brief moment in time, the antagonism between these two different worlds leads these people, not spontaneously, but like imminently, to live in a way that is like opposed to the imperial state and commercial capital, but also creative of the sort of politics that the larger class, the proletariat and the subaltern classes, would utilize 100 years later when they had the revolutions in Haiti. And right. So it's, and why I think that's an interesting frame to look at it is, I think that if we're looking towards like what a transition away from capitalism might look like, there will be, there has to be, this is the nature of systems with sort of imminent logics to them, that there will be antagonistic groups that are simply, quote unquote, reacting to modern, postmodern industrial capitalism, who are acting in ways, informing themselves in ways, organizing themselves in ways, even if it's just economically, but maybe even politically, in ways antagonistic that might potentially anticipate what the overcoming of capitalism might look like. Maybe in the fractures, maybe just on the frontiers, let's say, of 21st century capitalist life, but nevertheless, right? And this is why I think talking about the internet and internet piracy and intellectual property and its antagonists might be an interesting place to go in the bonus half, because I know, Ross, you have a decent amount of things to say about that. I guess for the main episode, one last question is, what happened to the Usecocks?
At some point, their boats were burnt by the Venetians in 1617. We didn't mention the difference between pirates and privateers, but Usecocks, they used to be privateers of the Austrian Empire, of the Habsburgs.
Ah.
I'll say that very quickly, against
the Venetians.
Against the Venetians, okay. Because the Austrians wanted to challenge the monopoly over the Adriatic Sea, the Gulf of Venice, as I said. But there's a gradual switch towards actual piracy. There's an Austrian commissioner who is sent to saying, to keep them in order at some point, and they kill him. And that's really the key moment of state failure in Senja. Senja, it's spelled S-E-N-J. Senja.
Okay, those Croatian words, man. Yeah. Holy shit.
At some point they become actual pirates. In the eyes of the state that was supposed to tolerate, to protect them as privateers at the very beginning of the history. These, their pirate actions lead to an actual war between the Habsburg Empire and Venice, taking place between 1615 and 17. Venice won the war, and so the treaty that was signed, the peace treaty at the end of this war, said that the Usecocks had to be replaced with other frontier warriors. They had to be transferred in other inner Balkan fortresses. So it kind of ended up. Today, we still have the imaginary of Usecocks. I
was going to say, if you're, and this is also anachronistic if you're talking the 17th century, but if you're like a Croatian nationalist in the 19th and 20th century, is this one, because nationalism is obviously the other great historical movement that arises later on, Are you nodding towards the used cocks?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So, these were brave and strong people. Fighting the infidel, the Ottomans that were Muslim. So there's a whole Islamophobic thing about the used cocks. Yeah,
maybe even Italian phobic too, right? Because Croatians probably hate the Italians a lot.
Yeah, because of the Italian colonization of Istria and Dalmatia, of course. So it was definitely recycled as a nationalist legend. Today there's a football team, our football, soccer team,
real football,
real actual football, named Hajduk Split, which is it's the football team of the city of Split, which was one of the main Venetian harbors along the Dalmatian coast. And the Hajduks were frontier warriors, very close to the Juzkoks. And of course, let's say most of the supporters of this team identified themselves as far-right people. And so, yes, there's definitely...
It's like an American team calling themselves the Pioneers or more darkly, like the Redskins or something like that. Gotcha. Yeah. Good stuff. I'm going to put links in here for your work. And in the second half, I'd like to talk a little bit about IP and piracy and how we can kind of bring this story forward. And also about your communist group, your Bordigas group, N+1, because we didn't have a chance to talk about it. We can put the link in the show notes for that too, and they can see what sort of shit Italian Bordigas are getting up to these days, including yourself. So with all that said, if you're not a patron of this show, I don't know why the hell you wouldn't be. If you want to hear more great content, the continuation of this discussion, go to patreon.com/theantifada, sign up, and we're going to be on the other side of that paywall. One last time, ILC is meeting all over the place. If you are in Chicago, Sunday the 29th, we hope to see you there. All right, thanks for listening, everyone. See you on the other side.